Thank you, Ms. Heino. I'm going to ask our Marshal Jack Fink to call court to order.
Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Werke, Judge Reyes, Judge Jessen, the Honorable Renee L. Werke presiding.
Good morning and welcome to ZoomGov, our new way of conducting business at the Court of Appeals. And thank you for participating in this fashion today. A couple of reminders, if there's anything that's wrong with technology on your end, wave your arms or try to say something and I will stop the counter so that we can fix whatever needs to be remedied. Also, please remember to state your name and introduce yourself before beginning your arguments. With that said, I'll ask our marshal to call the next case for hearing.
Now calling case number A200855. Sandra Thies Walls versus Coburn's Incorporated and James Roberts.
Hello, counsel, when you're ready to proceed, the floor is yours. Yes.
My name is Greg Walls and I represent the appellants. May it please the court, counsel. This court should know that the trial court judge has recused itself and a new trial judge has been assigned in the underlying case that was remanded to the trial court. Additionally, this court should know that the matter that was originally appealed and subsequently remanded to the trial court is still before the trial court. The appellate court asked that I have the motion to enforce either approved or disapproved in an order dated July 21st, 2020. Upon that order coming down, I immediately asked the trial court to rule on that part of the case. To date, that motion, almost a year later after I initially brought it, has not been ruled on yet. David Hare in his Bench and Bar in Minnesota, November 20 edition, says rules are rules, really. He states in a recent Sixth Circuit decision, In Re National Prescription Opiate Litigation 956 Federal 3rd 838, Sixth Circuit 2020, puts the imperative nature of court rules into sharp focus. The twin holdings of the case make it an often cited case. First, rules are to be followed. Second, the rules apply to judges too. Just as judges can expect the rules to be followed, the parties should apply the rules.
Mr. Walls, I have a rule I'd like to ask you about. As an initial matter, in your assertion that there was a settlement agreement that needs to be approved before an attorney lien could be established, you'd fail to cite any statutory interpretation or legal authority. Do you have any, or have you not waived that very argument?
I don't think I've waived that, Your Honor. I specifically make it in that his thing makes it conditional upon the order itself makes it conditional upon that being granted. And the other thing, how can you make something into a pie that doesn't exist?
I'm talking about, Mr. Walls, is that for appellate court proceedings, our rules, the rules that you're referring to that need to be adhered to, do require that you cite some case authority for the proposition you're maintaining. That's what I'm asking you. Where is that?
I don't believe, I'm not aware of any at this point, Your Honor. But I think the contract itself states that and the order of the court does, Your Honor. So the rules need to be followed both by judges and by the party participants. Rules in the law are what we all agree on. These are not, they are tied to morals and seek to avoid moral implications. They are minimum standards of conduct, not lofty standards that need to be challenged at every point and to the point of violating them. So the rules in this particular case, I think I've cited quite extensively, they're ethical rules. I know the other side doesn't want to follow them necessarily, but those rules, ethical rules, have caused other attorneys to feel the effects of them. For instance, there's an attorney that was convicted because he paid money to people to get cases to him. There's an attorney up in a northern county who failed to disclose Brady material, and all those cases were overturned and he was disbarred. So the rules of ethics have meaning. In Christensen versus Egan, the appellate court says it's just a guideline, but the Supreme Court in Christensen versus Egan says it must be followed. So
Mr. Walls, if I may, so you're talking about the rules, and I just had a question about the rules that you are citing. I mean, starting with rule 1.8A about whether separate writings are required. There's a comment to that rule that said, look, this doesn't apply to, you know, to fee arrangements. So why is rule 1.8A applicable here? I don't see the business transaction and I see this comment.
Well, the fee arrangement, I don't know where there's a client, how that would apply in this case. If you're a client, you're a client. It doesn't say if I'm a client as well as an attorney in the case, doesn't negate the fact that I'm a client as well. So I think it still applies.
You're a client of Mr. Roberts?
Well, I was a dual capacity, Your Honor. I am a client of the trustee, correct? I'm a client who's going to get benefits from this particular case. I have to be given notice of any distribution, correct? I'm the grandfather of the deceased.
Mr. Walls, I understand that you are serving those roles, but I'm just trying to understand, looking at Rule 1.8, which applies to business transactions between lawyers and clients. I mean, just specifically tell me, what's the business transaction here?
It's the retainer, Your Honor.
But isn't that then a fee agreement, which is addressed by the comment to the rule?
I am not aware of that. I don't think it was cited by anyone. It wasn't argued, so I can't respond to that just right now. So again.
Do we even need to address that issue, Mr. Waltz? I share Judge Justin's concern about whether or not that's even applicable. I mean, isn't really your main argument of the rule 1.5E?
That Christensen versus Egan, that should have been, I believe that's correct. And there's all kinds of evidence, and I'm not gonna, you know, I don't think there's any disputed evidence about the degree and the amount of work done by anyone. The scope of review and the standard of review, I've identified those issues. I don't think there's any dispute about that. So I don't think there are a lot of factual issues. The court can, in this case, the appellate court, do an independent review of the facts and make a determination of what's appropriate.
Well, Mr. Wallace, let me stop you there. I don't think that's our role. We are just an error correcting court to determine whether or not the district court's decision was correct. We don't go through and review the record again to make a determination one way or another. So
I think that's incorrect. First, this is a strictly paper decision made on paper. There's no testimony, no cross-examination. So what is it that you would have to defer to that the district court did? Secondly, the orders that were ultimately approved were drafted by opposing counsel, and those orders should not be given deference generally either by the appellate court. So, and
but the reasonable value of the attorney fees is an issue of fact. That's issues of fact are determined by the district court, not by this court. And the validity of the attorney's lien is also an issue of fact. Again, that's where we give deference to the district court to make that determination.
Again, I have case law cited in my brief, but strictly paper review, and also that the judge didn't exercise any independent judgment because she verbatim basically adopted the other party's findings.
Well, but I think the record reflects that the district court carefully reviewed all of the documents that were filed by both parties before making a determination.
Well, if you look at what was actually submitted by the parties, Mr. Roberts submitted about 5 pages of information. I submitted a voluminous amount of documents reflecting what was actually done and how it was done, Your Honor. So, and I'm not going to go into what those facts are. I think they're self-sustaining and self-supporting. So, and Christensen versus Egan, you know, at this point, there are 2 things, I guess. The waiver issue with respect to 1.8 And number two, I think what are the amount of fees? He's agreed that $569,305 is the total fee at this time. So even how you split that up, that amount up under Christensen versus Egan, the court has to do that. So
but didn't the district court do that?
Well, if the district court did that, the question is they never approved anything yet. They never made any judgment as to how it should be divided. So $569,305, half of that, if you presume there's a joint fee retainer, is something like $200,000+, correct? So, and if we start to allocate the amount of work between, you know, that amount of money having a joint fee agreement at half, who shows what and who knows what is where, so.
But the fee agreement doesn't say anything about division of fees. It doesn't say anything that the fees would be divided evenly.
I think as this court should know, and I believe I'm correct, you can't even do that on the initial phase. If you're trying to allocate or say one person gets 20% and not tie it to how much is actually done, I think the rules indicate that that's improper, Your Honor.
Right, I agree with you there, but I think the district court already did that analysis. The district court looked to determine what was the actual work that had been done and allocated the fees based on its determination of what work had been done by both parties.
I don't know where you see that. You know, it certainly drafted an order that was adopted verbatim versus basically from the other attorney. And that attorney's order refers to the work I put into the record, not his own work. And so
anything else, Mr. Walls?
No, I'm not going to say anything more.
All right, you'll have 5 minutes reserved for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Mr. Roberts, we turn to you.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's very much a privilege to address the panel this morning. First of all, regarding the trial court's recusal, there's actually two different files. There's the file for the distribution to the heirs, and that would be file number, district court file number 792. And there's also the file number 837, which pertains to the distribution of attorney's fees. They're completely two separate issues. Now, the court did not recuse herself on the attorney fee issue. The court remains presiding over that issue. When it gets remanded, whatever happens, she will be the judge. And on the distribution to the heirs, the trial court only recused herself after Mr. Walls began disparaging the court and her staff. And the trial court is very protective of her staff. They didn't need to go through that. And so she just simply recused herself. It went to another judge who's taking care of it.
I'm sorry to interrupt, Mr. Roberts, but I just want to make sure that Attorney Walls is still present. Right now you have a blank screen. Okay, as long as we know you're there, thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Roberts.
Thank you, Your Honor. The findings of fact in this case, I would think, because of the nature of this proceeding, are probably a little bit more significant than other proceedings. And in this case, not only the judge presiding over this for months and months, she was not only presiding over this, she was a referee. There was daily contact with the court. There was flack going between Mr. Walls and the defense attorney's office, flack between Mr. Walls and my office and the court. And a lot of that isn't of record. But my feeling is if the court, because of the nature of the proceeding, if the court developed impressions, beliefs because of that, I think that's fair game. And obviously that's what happened. And the trial court in this case showed incredible patience and restraint with Mr. Walls. And I think I know other trial court judges may not have dealt with this in this way, but she did. Very, very patient. Didn't restrict his filings, never restricted any evidence, didn't restrict any testimony. She allowed him complete discretion as to what he filed and what he said. So if there's any argument about him not placing his evidence or not able to get his evidence in, that's just absolutely false. In the trial court, there was no complaints about the trial court until the trial court ruled against him. And all the information about being rogue and corruption and biased and everything like that, there wasn't a word of that until she ruled against him, and everything was fine up until then. And the same thing would be true with me. Now, his first communication with me when I reduced the attorney fees and reallocated all the distribution of the proceeds and everything like that, he never said a word about any dissatisfaction with my office. And all these things that came up later, violation of the professional rules, he didn't do this and he didn't do that. All of that was an afterthought. And you'd think the very first time that he submitted that information to me, reducing my attorney's fees and reallocating the proceeds, taking the money away from the child and everything like that, he would have had some basis for doing that. And at that time, he should have said, well, Mr. Roberts, you didn't do this, you didn't do that. You know, you violated a professional rule. You know, you should have done this. And I can say before you today, anything that he would have asked me to do legally, I would have done it. I've worked with this family for years and years and years, and I've shown them nothing but hard work and honesty. And if there is a complaint, it should have been brought up at that time. Everybody at the mediation, we sat down at the mediation and it was settled. And I signed the settlement agreement for $2.75 million. Everybody was happy. There's absolutely no problems whatsoever.
Mr. Roberts?
Yes.
I'd like to direct you to what I think is probably the key question. The key legal issue here is, and ask you, what's your best argument with respect to potential violation of the Minnesota Rule of Professional Conduct 1.5E?
No, 1.5E, which, I'm trying to think which one is that now. Is what, are you sure you don't, is that, are you?
About the fee agreement.
Okay. No, is that, that's the rule that says it has to be in writing, the distribution has to be in writing before, you know, is that?
Yes.
Okay. Now that rule, the research, and I'm very familiar with this, I contacted the board at the time this case was started, and I contacted the board in January of 2020. Now that rule is designed to stop a referring lawyer from getting a referral fee for doing no work. It's the receiving attorney. It's not the receiving attorney, it's the referring attorney. And so the reason for that rule is to prohibit lawyers who get cases, like in Mr. Wall's case, it's his family, and who don't do no work, but refer it out and then expect to get paid. And that's the basis in looking at all the commentary and all the other information. And that's it. If there ever was a reason for this rule, it's this case right here. And the trial court found that I did all the work. And I, you know, whatever it was, 96% of the costs. But the basis for that rule, and that's an excellent question, because the basis of that rule is to make sure that a referring attorney, which Mr. Walls has described himself in his memorandum, does not reap the benefits for doing no work. And he wants, $700,000 out of this case. And he wants to give me, something very substantially less. And, you know, I can tell you that it was me in the forefront of everything. I mean, I ordered all the records. I dealt with the county attorney, victims' rights advocates, everything. I mean, it was a daily thing with me. So that rule is focused on a referring attorney and not the receiving attorney who does the work. And I hope I addressed that correctly, and maybe I'm confusing the panel more. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, when I look at your arguments and the way you frame the issue, you talked about whether or not the district court had erred in not considering that rule, and instead, you know, in terms of determining the amount of the attorney fee lien. And I guess that leads to another question. Do you see, I'm trying to understand really what the key issue here is, or key issues. It seems that the key issue is whether or not the district court erred in its determination, or perhaps stated another way, the way you frame the third issue, whether or not there's sufficient support in the record for the district court's determination. I'm just trying to get a handle on, you know, what really are the key, what's the key issue, or what are the key issues here?
Well, I'm not sure. As far as a reversal of those findings of fact, I don't think Mr. Wallace has submitted any information, legal authority, or anything to set aside the court's findings of fact. She applied the right law. She went to the statute. The legislature has determined that this proceeding is to be something called a summary proceeding, not something, and even the preamble to the board rules, it specifically says these rules are not to be used as a tool for litigation and oppression. And this is to be a summary proceeding. And the court considered all the information and heard testimony. I can't imagine how much time the trial court spent on this case. And for a long time, it probably, her office worked on this half the time. But that's the key issue, is that Mr. Walls wants the court to go beyond this, and he wants to prove a legal malpractice case and violations of the rules of professional responsibility and everything else. And the case law says, no, you can't, that's not, it's supposed to be a summary proceeding. This is not supposed to be a long drawn out thing. And so that would be my response to that. I think that the trial court, at the first hearing, she was a little fuzzy on the facts, but when we got to the second and third hearings, the trial court was very well versed, read everything, and you could, it was very clear that the trial court understood the entire file, and I think the trial court applied the correct law. And that's really all I have, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Roberts. We'll turn then back to Attorney Walls. You'll have the last ability to say, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Well, I think if you look at my briefs, there are issues of ripeness, failure to have a separate writing, standard review, scope of review, whether the rules of professional conduct apply, and other things. It's all in the record, and this court can review the record de novo, because it's been a written record. And I don't think there's any other questions. I'm not going to say anything anymore. It's
court then thanks both attorneys for appearing in this fashion today. And I would be remiss if I did not express condolences to the family as well as the friends of this child that has passed away. That's not a matter that's before us, but I do want to express the court's sympathies. Now, with that said, the matters are under advisement. A decision will be issued within the statutory timeframe on the issues that are presented to us today. Panel judges, we can mute and stop video, and I will initiate a discussion pending our next hearing, which is half an hour from now.